I think we all try to grapple with the situations, try to intellectualize it. It's not only the academicians or the scholars or the students or the researchers like me, everybody. My parents did it, Sears workers did it. I was talking to them, even the invisible laborers, they do it. They try to understand what's happening around them. And we try to theorize that. And then we come up with new ideas, and they also do the same thing. So I think it's a just little kind of, an attempt, a small attempt to understand what's happening around us now.
Hello and welcome to the Deindustrialization and Politics of Our Time podcast. My name is Gabriel Ellison Scowcroft, and I'm pursuing a master's in history at Concordia University in Montreal, Canada, more correctly known as Shokshoge. It is important to recognize that the Ganyagahaga Nation are the custodians of this land. Today, Indranil Chakraborty is with me to talk about the monograph that came out of his PhD research, and also about the research that he's doing currently as a postdoc for the Deindustrialization and Politics of Our Time project. So to start off, Indranil, can you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you, Gabriel. Thank you for this inviting me for this podcast. So I did my graduation in modern Indian history from India. And after that, I went to the profession of journalism. And for 12 years as a journalist, my area was information technology, telecom, artificial intelligence, analytics, all this kind of modern digital technology, you can say. And then I was getting bored with the job, you may say. Who'd like to have early morning call from the editor to say whether I'm missing a story on Bill Gates or, let's say, Narayan Murthy Infosys? So I decided, okay, I still love journalism, make no mistake, but then I thought, okay, let's do something else. Let's kind of look at what's happening in the other parts of the world. So my wife, my partner, she was doing her PhD at Vancouver, UBC, sociology. So I joined her. I started doing my second master's in communication studies at Simon Fraser. And then from Simon Fraser, after finishing my MA very quickly, kind of 1.5 years, I moved directly for my PhD to Western University, University of Western Ontario, to do my PhD under Professor Nick Dyer Rutherford. And there I did a PhD on the subject of the book, the support service workers in Indian IT industry. That's all about. And after that, now here, you know, like, so I wrote to Stephen that I want to join his great project of deindustrialization. And he accepted me. And so I'm here doing the postdoc at Concordia.
Great. Thank you. I'm just curious if there's a direct link between the sort of journalism. I mean, obviously, there's a direct link between the journalism work that you were doing and this book that we're going to talk about. But was it something that you sort of consciously went back to school to think about, or in the sense that did you go back to school with a kind of project like this in mind because of what you were doing, or did it arise naturally?
So there was a connection. Okay, so I was in the kind of student politics for a long period of time during my master's and bachelor's degree. And then I moved to journalism, and there also I was in technology. So from the very beginning, I was looking at the relationship between labor and technology, even in my journalism reporting, okay? Because, so Indian IT industry I was engaged with in my writing, and Indian IT industry is a very interesting IT industry. In a sense, it grew from a situation where India was basically a public sector dominated economy, then to a private sector IT industrial scenario where people from middle class, upper middle class, they started the business. Okay, it was not the government opened up the market, but they started them. They took the initiative. Okay, but then I thought, what about the others, like the coders, the information technology people? Okay, who would work for long hours and what kind of money they will get? So that was my kind of inquiry, and then I moved to the people, the support service workers, those who actually run the operation, okay? The janitors, the housekeepers, the people who serve food to the coders, okay? To the information technology personnel during the day, during the night hours. So I was interested in a whole gamut of people who are working in IT industry, along with the technology. So how technology is, the impact of technology on them, impact of technology on society, and how it's changing that the entire working class structure. That was my interest. So when I went to Simon Fraser and worked with my professor, Robert Anderson, I started working at a different level, like understanding like socialist politics and modern world and labor and technology. So that was the beginning.
So the work that we've been talking about here is the book that came out of your PhD research. The title is Invisible Labor: Support Service Workers in India's Information Technology Industry, and it came out in January this year. Can you offer a brief sort of introduction on top of what you've already outlined about this book?
Yeah, sure. So if you look at the Indian IT industry, it has a phenomenal growth. Okay, in 1979-80, the industry's revenue was around $150 million. By 2016 and 17, the revenues touched $154 billion. And today it's around $194-95 billion. So that's the kind of growth. So this growth, who were the agents of this growth? So normal discourse is, as you see, if in Canada or in the US, you have Parag Agarwal, the Twitter CEO. So you have Sundar Pichai and other people. So it seems that these are the people, the IIT graduates, the upper class, upper caste people, okay? They were the driver of the growth. Yes, they were. They are the drivers of the growth. The learned people, they are the learned people. They're extremely kind of entrepreneurs they are. And they really made what Indian IT industry is today. But what we forget are the people, the invisible laborers, the support service workers, the people, the security guards, okay, the housekeepers, the janitors, the people who ferry Parag Agarwal from home to office, office to home, the bus drivers who will take the thousands of software professionals at night, or the call center people, okay? So they have a major contribution in this, okay? So I want to, the book is about them, okay? And who are they? From where did they come from? Okay, all these things happened in post-1990s, the period of globalization, and in a sense, in a kind of new liberal framework of economy. All this happened from 1990 onwards in India. And so these are the people, these are migrant workers. Most of them came from the villages. So they enter into a new relationships and an opportunity to belong to organization associations different from their family, kinship, community-based engagements. So the exchanges open up a universe that is qualitatively different from their experience as rural inhabitants. 90% are rural people. They came from the rural areas. They're migrants. So unknown faces became their friends. Union membership at the workplace and social media platforms create their public image. Sports club and cultural groups provide respite from their work monotony, and intimacy with media, gadgets, apps, and branded goods confirm their urban status. It's a new home, and the world pops up in front of their eyes. However, this is not a straightforward transition from an old to a new network of social relationship that shaped their ideology, outlook, and conversation. It is neither the grafting of traditional ideologies over the workers' modern space, guiding them in their economic pursuits, nor a substitution of their family values, norms, and beliefs by an ideology of positive individualism. The new relationships create an identity, a transition from a country person to become a city dweller, who over time becomes a part of a hyper-competitive environment by selling his or her labor. This is the subject of the book. How they're surviving. Why it's invisible? They're producing value, but they're working 5 days, 6 days a week, earning, let's say, $150, $200, 8 to 10 hours a day. So you can understand, like, if today IT CEO earning out $1 million, like, a year.
Mm-hmm. Which would probably be, they probably earn much more than that. I don't know, but.
No, I saw that Parag Agarwal, his earning is $1 million
okay.
a year. That's what he's getting. Mm-hmm. Plus, you have the stock options and other things. Okay, I'm just talking about the salary part. Mm-hmm. And this guy is getting $150 a month. That means how much? In a year, it will be $1,800 a year. So is this, like, so what capitalism says that, so Ms. Parag Agarwal of Twitter earning $1 million a year, and the invisible laborer earning $1,800 a year, are we saying that their skill sets is so hugely different, the differences are so huge that you have kind of what, 100, 2,000, 3,000 times more salary that one can get over the other?
Yeah.
And I don't think no sane person will agree to this.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so that's what is about this book, Invisible Labor.
I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, but is it Gautam?
Gautam Sen.
So the dedication at the beginning of the book says, yeah. For Gautam Sen, whose struggle for a just world has been a constant source of inspiration. Can you tell me the story behind that?
Okay. So I used to be involved with a leftist group, okay, which believes in worker self-emancipation. Okay. So the famous Marxist quote is that the emancipation of the workers is the act of the workers themselves. So there is no mediator between, okay? Neither the party nor the leadership. It's the workers who will decide their future. So we have this small left group in Calcutta, and we became something up. We are very close to the revolutionary tradition of the Marxism of Trotsky, of Leon Trotsky, Rosa Luxemburg, a little bit of Lenin, and we believe that is a workers' council, and they are the way to go for the workers' emancipation. Okay, it's not a bureaucratic state apparatus dictated workers' movement.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So and he really, I'll say he not a leader. He was certainly not a leader. He died just a few months back. He was not certainly a leader, but he was the main intellectual who developed this idea, following Marx's understanding of self-emancipation of working class. Till now, a major trend in working class politics, in labor politics, is that it's a kind of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin's understanding that workers cannot learn things through practice. There should be someone from outside, the leader, the party, or the socialist state, that they will control workers' life and teach them, okay? So, and then we have seen the consequences of that in the Russian Revolution, and Chinese Revolution, in other revolutionary projects, okay? But I'm not in a believer of total spontaneity, okay? There is an ideology, there is a hegemony, and Gramsci, my favorite theoretician will be, workers' theoretician will be Rosa Luxemburg and Gramsci, and Lenin to an extent, okay? Like Lenin's What Is to Be Done was created in a very difficult situation, okay? In a very authoritarian social condition, okay? So at some point of time, you need to have a party to guide the revolution. But what would be the extent of that? Okay, we have seen in 1917, there's a great revolution from below, and then the revolution lost its way after 1924-25, went to a kind of Stalinism, which created a kind of dictatorial, authoritarian regime in Russia. All these things happened, okay? So in this book also, what I tried to do is to look at the spontaneity level, what the workers are saying, also at a objective level, like what workers can do or can't do. So the basic theme of this book at the end is, many people say that it's a very pessimistic, okay, in a sense that I don't know whether there can be, these workers will ever fight for their rights. Like, they are fighting every day, no doubt. But I am saying that there can be an ultimate win they can achieve. What they want to achieve, good education for their son and daughter, good living for them, good modern gadgets for them, good food, good dress, all kind of things, okay? That means at par with their bosses. Whether they can achieve that or not, I'm not sure. That's what I'm saying here, okay? It's an open-ended question. I don't think there is anything called determined revolutionary thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. Nothing is determined, mm-hmm, in this world. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of ifs and buts. Mm-hmm. So this book's about telling the story, their story, their life condition, and without saying that, without kind of have a very positive, definite answer how these things will be solved. I didn't answer those questions.
Hmm. Oh, it's very interesting. Thank you for that. Okay. So it seems that a big part of this book is dedicated to understanding the changing social relations that have deep impacts on workers' lives in the specific context of information technology parks. And you pose a question in your introduction that I'm going to ask you here, and maybe just ask you to reflect on the question and how you went about answering it, or maybe even why the question is important. So the question that you pose in the introduction is, how does the accelerated modern lifestyle lead to ruptures and discontinuities with the past?
So most of these people, this employees, they move from the village or semi-urban areas to the big cities, okay? And most of them were disguised unemployed in Indian labor market in the rural areas. So their productivity was very low. They were suffering from various things, malnutrition to an extent, earning was low. They used to live together most of the time. It's not an individual family. Many of them don't have permanent house structure, and they used to work like more than 12, 14 hours, 15 hours. There's caste oppression. Everything you think of about Indian life, they suffered. Like, they are poor. They're poor people, basically. Many of them were below poverty line, and some obviously little above poverty line, but they were not by any standard you can call them middle class. Some of them may be from lower middle class, okay? So when they moved to the cities, big cities, what happened, okay? And that's what I was trying to understand through the interviews, okay? So basically it was a mixed methods I took. That means that after I met them, I provided them a questionnaire, which is about their demographic situation, about their educational attainment, about their economic background, what their parents did, what they did, what is their level of education, all kind of things. And based on the answers of that, we had a kind of semi-structured questionnaire. I asked them questions and they answered, and the result is this book. Okay, so to go to the question that I was asking in the book, we have to understand one thing, that the IT industry in the metropolis offers workers an escape from a life of defined by poverty and drudgery. Okay. Though there is a debate that how far that globalization really served the people of the third world or the developing countries like India and Bangladesh and other places, IT industry, by the example IT industry shows, that it has lifted a considerable section of people from below poverty. Okay. This is a drastic change from their part-time or seasonal employment on a farm or in a local factory, where besides long hours and unsafe working conditions, especially for women, workers depend on the employer's mercy to receive even the legally mandated minimum wage. Based on their past economic situations, it is rational to opt for employment as an outsourced worker in the IT industry. All these support service workers were outsourced workers. Okay, they are not direct employees of Microsoft or Cisco or or Infosys. Okay, for these workers, the act of rationality to comprehend reality is a painful journey, fractured by struggle, contradictions, and ambivalence. These complex and varied sociological and psychological states reveal themselves in interviews through the narration of their everyday communicative experiences in dealing with spouses, children, employers, colleagues, or even with the bus conductors where they were traveling. It is tempting to refer to the social transition of these workers as moving into a new stage of capitalist modernity, because they are in that here. So they are having a kind of modern life, from a state of traditional communitarian culture to a journey from an authentic state of communal existence to a degraded world of individual communal culture. However, I think this is a false dichotomy. The false dichotomy is that it's a modern state of modernity and that's the state of authentic communitarian life. It's this transition. This is a false dichotomy, what I am saying in this book. The present, my ethnography, shows that workers have variegated response to social and cultural displacements. Between universality of the global order and the heterogeneity of cultural experience, there are disquieting moments to grapple with mundane issues of life, such as bread and employment. These are the moments when support service workers face the ambiguities and paradoxes of capitalist modernity's promises of equality, liberty, and fraternity. So we just can't say this, that it's just a transformation from authentic rural life to a very inhuman modern life. Also, we can't say this, that this modern life for them is great, and they have enjoyed that. Yes, they are enjoying a part of it. They're not enjoying the other part of it. they are not enjoying the inhuman part of it. They are enjoying the part of it that they had mobile phone and they can see movies on the mobile phone. They can enjoy because they can take their son and daughter to McDonald's, not every day, but once in a month, which was not possible while they were staying in the rural areas. They were enjoying things like new things they are seeing, the fast car they are seeing, though they will never buy it. But also at the same time, they were enjoying that the children are learning English and mathematics, which will one day, they hope that will make their children IT consultant someday. So that's what they were happy with to live. Whether that can happen or that can really happen, obviously most of the cases will not happen. Okay, because the education system requires money and they don't have that money. Okay, but still, it's their hope. Okay, so their hope now is entirely different from what they are hoping back in villages. So there's a transformation of change happening. Okay, but this transformation, is it a unidirectional? It's a one way? No, it's not. There are many kind of back and forth movement. Emotional movement, material movement, many movements. And we should be careful to understand those movements. The promise and reality.
Yeah.
Great, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a promise. There's a promise that they will live a better life. They're living a better life compared to the village life in terms of material conditions. I'm not talking about the emotional state. Many of them complain to me, oh, there are no friends here. There are many things are missing here. No, I used to love the village life. Like one guy told me that this is a great life. I enjoy it. But if I have the opportunity, I'll go back to the village, not as a laborer. But I will start a bike factory because Indian villages need good bikes because the roads condition is not so great. So I will start a bike factory, not as a laborer. So this is the transformation I'm talking about. The new liberal people will say, oh, look at this, the kind of entrepreneurial transformation happening. But they made a mistake that this is not entrepreneurial transformation only. This is a transformation of knowing something new. Something new is happening in their life. So they're trying to encash. Okay, it might be very instrumental in it may sound, but they try to trying to be a part of that new thing, new life.
Can you maybe say something that you would like people to come away with after reading this book?
Yeah, two things I think that's important that from this book, like the takeaway. You mean the takeaway?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a much better
yeah. So one thing is that we always talk about globalization in a sense that people have been deprived of their material livings, and they are now living a precarious life. I think that in some cases, people's life have improved. Okay, it might may sound controversial, but inequality has increased, but their life has also improved. So it's in a relative sense they are better. Materially, they are better, okay? And so there is nothing called authentic life. Life grows out of your exchanges with society. Life grows out of your changing relationships with one another, with technology. And so so from a old situation, we are going to a new situation, but it's not a direct transformation. The new also carries the old with them. So it's not a definite break. At the same time, it's not a binary, old versus new. That's number one takeaway. And the second thing that I think that's important to understand is how we define working class now. Okay. In the digital world, you have people like Airbnb people, you have Uber people, you have all those e-commerce people who provide, who come to a place, to our place to hand over our food. Are they working class or not? Okay. Are these support service workers a working class or not? So how do we define a working class? And that's a challenge. And I have faced this challenge here also. Okay. Because in my case, in invisible labor, it's easy to define the working class. These are the people who are really the working class. But in other cases, it may not be easy to define it, because their relationship with capital is not straightforward. Okay, and then also to understand that. So my point is that here is that there's always, at every point of the development of productive force, that means technology, there is every time a decomposition and recomposition of workforce happens. So working class changes from, let's say, a village marginal laborer to a outsourced worker. So his job changes, his mentality changes, his objective position changes, but that doesn't mean that working class is vanishing. Okay, they are there with different kind of work, with different kind of employment relationship. So we have to understand that. Like many people say, particularly who are supporters of new liberal economy, that there is no working class. All of us are becoming kind of self-employed. Okay, I think that's not the right thing to say. This is something which is not right or true or whatever.
So transitioning from talking about invisible labor, can you introduce the work that you're currently doing for deindustrialization and the politics of our time?
So this is my postdoctoral research, which is examining how deindustrialization, like the closures of retail stores like Sears, and reindustrialization, that means that, for example, Amazon retail fulfillment centers in North America and Europe are changing the everyday life experiences of the laboring population. So my plan is to study the crisis in which displaced workers and retirees of the retail giant Sears Canada, which was declared bankrupt in 2017, what are the consequences they're facing and what is their everyday life situation now? So basically my research aims at capturing the everyday lived experiences of these laid off workers and their retired colleagues across class, gender, community, family, and ethnicity. The study promises to record the narratives of their survival stories and examine how they negotiate their lives through economic sufferings, family demands, neighbor scorn, failed job searches, sense of inadequacy, physical inability to work, and embarrassment at relying upon community help. So that's what I'm trying to do through interviews, oral interviews, trying to understand their everyday and everydayness of lived experience of their life.
Can you talk a little bit more about how you're using oral history as a methodology, or why oral history as a methodology is something that's useful to you here, or that you were interested in?
Yeah, one of the things that oral history is important is to let the interviewee talk, okay? And the great thing about oral history as a theory is that when they talk, they say many things which are contradictory. Okay, the same thing happened with my invisible labor. So I asked them to talk, or I asked them to narrate their life story. And when they're doing, they're saying contradictory things. Okay? And my understanding is that through contradictions, because life is always contradictory, and contradictions, new possibilities arrive. So I can tell you one story here that I've already started doing the interview. So I was interviewing a Bangladeshi Hindu lady who migrated from Dhaka to Toronto, like 2000, I think, in the year 2000. So she was telling me that in 2009 in Vancouver, she joined Sears and worked till the closing of Sears 2017, when the boss came and told her, "You have to stop work, you have to leave now, we are closing." And she said, I started crying because I loved Sears so much. Okay, it gave me respect as an immigrant. The other job in Toronto, the other retail store, I faced harassments, but here it's such a great company. Then I asked her, "So did you get the minimum wage here?" She said, "Yeah, 2009 I started getting minimum wage, and 2017 I was getting the minimum wage." I said, "In over the period of what, 7 years, 8 years, your wage didn't increase, or few cents increase, and you didn't say anything." She said, "No, they're nice people, and I didn't feel of telling them anything, or arguing for bettering my minimum wage." And then I asked her, "Did you ever consider forming a union?" She said, "No, never it occurred to me." So this is the contradiction. What happened? What really happened? Like, why? She, is it not economies more than your emotional thing? That you're not getting money, but still you are not questioning. Okay, why is this? And if, then I was thinking that this lady, who was a Hindu in Bangladesh, obviously a minority in Bangladesh, because majority of Bangladeshis were Muslim. Mm-hmm. And then she moved here and she faced all kinds of difficulties, and Sears gave her a little bit of emotional stability. And then her husband got a job as an engineer here, and her money was not something for the family, but to save for the future home buying. So it was not her money, like, it was not a kind of, her money didn't provide the family a kind of everyday living cost, like didn't have the meet the everyday living cost. It's just a kind of saving for the next, for the future home buying, for the future home. So for that reason, she didn't have much complaint. There are material things that also kind of led her to not to question her minimum wage and getting the same wage for seven, eight, 8 years. So this is the beauty of oral history. Like you can, like if it was a plain interview, then I would have stopped there. And I said, "Oh, okay. So you respect Sears. Sears is a great company. The Sears human resource is really great. Department is a great department." And I would not have questioned her. I would not have connected her minimum wage with her respect comment. or why she didn't try to be a part of the union, or why didn't she thought of forming a union in Sears. So I think this is the reason why oral history is great. Kind of, it tees out the inner contradictions.
Why this project and why now? What is it about? Yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
So this project is a part of the Big Shot project, which is deindustrialization of the politics of time. Okay, the question is what these potential changes that's happening across the world we are seeing, the acceleration that we are seeing, every hour, every minute, every second is different. I don't think the world has seen this ever. Okay, people will say that, like, we are talking now, and while we are talking, something is changing around us. Okay, so what these potential changes mean for the politics of time? We have seen popular protests, conservative reactions, and identitarian ideas in the global north. So what this signify in relation to deindustrialization, in relation to the closing of Sears factory, a Sears retail store? Okay, closing of the Sears. What exactly the connection? Okay, related to this is the question whether global north and south are weaved into a single frame of deindustrialization and reindustrialization that may throw Sears workers into the vortex of informal, unpaid, and insecure underemployment. The technology and application of complex financial mathematical models led to the development of speculative financial instruments, which in turn seamlessly established the capital flow from the global north to south. All the pension funds are investing in India or in China or in the developing country because there you are getting more return. While the south needs technology, obviously you can see the big data, artificial intelligence, cloud computing, as well as capital from the north, the return for the north comprises value production at the lowest cost, leveraging on cheap labor and extraction of natural resources. For example, I can tell you shirts and trousers made in Vietnam, India, and Bangladesh. So now what's happening is that it's costly here. And Sears face the same problem. It's costly to manufacture here. So you have shirts and trousers coming from Bangladesh. Yesterday there was a movie here in Concordia, made in Bangladesh. That was shown in Concordia, made in Bangladesh. And it shows that what happens at the lowest possible cost, you can make those things and then transfer it here for the people living in Canada and in the US or in Europe. Okay. So I contend that is a vital condition in keeping the North's new economy going. That means everything will be there, most of the manufacturing will be there, and then it will be transferred here at lowest cost. And basically it's a division of labor kind of thing. So the North is basically a kind of repository of new learning, and the South is a place for manufacturing. So these two are kind of interacting this way. So that's the politics of the time that's happening, okay? So one complements the other. It is a simultaneous creative destruction, deindustrialization, and there's a creative reconstruction, reindustrialization, that has created an interdependent global financial and industrial world. So this interdependence is creating more precarious labor, more precarious situation, and inequality, which I don't think there is any way to escape this. Today, the countries that in the south, in the north, are becoming more trying to become more self-sufficient, which is not possible. Like, they can't because the whole neoliberal economy rests on the fact that you have to produce things at lowest cost. and that is capitalism, basically. If there is cost is if you produce a shoe here at $5, and then that same shoe cost in India $1, the basic trade theory will say you should not produce here, you should produce in India. So I don't know how this will one can overcome, like Canada or in the US can overcome this cost arbitrage.
So then can you say a little bit more about why you think it's important to do the work that you're doing, given what you just said?
Yes.
Where does the work that you're doing now in talking to former Sears employees who were let go after the company went bankrupt, sort of how does that fit into everything that you just said?
Trying to understanding the situation, trying to get what's happening around me, around us, because that's very important to devise an alternative strategy, to create a different kind of public policy, to create a different world. Without this, we can't do it. So every moment, it's a practice, which is not only kind of labor practice, but also intellectual practice, both labor and intellectual practice, together can give you the direction. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong, but it will set a direction that how we should move forward. And for us, the people who are suffering, those who are not bourgeois, but who are belong to the laboring population, from the academics to the Sears workers, we have to do this in different ways to understand. Because I think to understand what's happening, I think we all try to grapple with the situations. Try to intellectualize it. It's not only the academicians or the scholars or the students or the researchers like me. Everybody. My parents did it. Sears workers did it. I was talking to them. Even the invisible laborers, they do it. They try to understand what's happening around them. And we try to theorize that. And then we come up with new ideas, and they also do the same thing. So I think it's just a little kind of, an attempt, a small attempt to understand what's happening around us now.
By way of closing, unless there's something else you'd like to say after this, but I was wondering if you could reflect on how you have changed focus over the course, you know, between these two projects that we've talked about, Invisible Labor, and now this project that you're doing with Sears workers, both in terms of the shift from, in the case of your previous work, the creation of this new proletariat, as you sort of call it in the book, to this context where you're interviewing people about job loss, about displacement, and also about the change in focus from India, from the global south, to working in the global north. I'm wondering if you could just sort of reflect on that trajectory and if there's anything in particular that has really struck you in this process of moving from one to the other or moving between.
Yeah, from the days of Industrial Revolution to now, capitalism is always a global system, okay? And previously, it was a slow growth. Acceleration was not there. Now it has a fast and fast and faster growth with acceleration happening every second. That's the difference. Now, so my area of research is labor and technology. And at every point of time, this labor and technology is becoming global. What we produce there, we can't produce in India or in Bangladesh or in Africa unless we have the inputs, technological inputs from here, from the north, or getting a mineral, particular input, production input from, let's say, from Chile or from South America. So this is a global production system. And so when I started with it, with this invisible labor book, so IT is a very global. So what the Indian companies or the foreign companies are doing in India is they're serving the banks, the various kinds of other various kinds of industries in the global north from India, or people from India coming here doing IT services for different industries, retail, banking, power, manufacturing. So they are doing all these kind of things. So it's globally connected, connecting the north to the south, okay? So when I moved here, I thought it's time to look at what's happening here. So my book was looking the north from the south, from the southern south, the vantage point of south where I am, I'm looking at the north. And now I'm looking north from the south from the north. The immigrants who worked in Sears, the kind of goods and services that Sears sourced from the southern countries, the pension funds now investing in the south, in India and other places. So what is happening to all these kind of things? So it's a two-way kind of research. First it was from looking the north from the south, and now it's looking the south from the north and understanding where I am at present. So the global space, it's always a global space. The only thing that the focus was south, now the focus is north. That's what I'm doing now. Because we have to understand that at every moment, any development also means underdevelopment at certain point of time, unless there is an equal distribution of productive capacity, which is not happening.
Thank you so much, Indranil, for doing this, for talking about your past and your present work. And I hope that we can have you back on once the next book is published.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about my research and for giving me the opportunity to reach my the other friends and affiliates and outside world, and to talk about my book and my for future research. I want to, as a caveat, it's not that I always am right, okay? The research is always... It's always helpful in the research project when we discuss, we debate, and we interrogate each other's work. And that's what I think moves me forward.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Thank you again.
Yeah.